Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James Paul, Executive Director of the Global Policy Forum, who examines the considerable difficulties facing the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the credibility of the Bush administration's plan for a transition to Iraqi rule. Eva Golinger-Moncada of the Venezuelan Solidarity Committee, who assesses the campaign by opponents of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to collect the 2.4 million signatures required to hold a national recall referendum. And Solly Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action, who discusses the global AIDS pandemic and his organization's focus on tearing down the obstacles which stand in the way of more progress on combating the disease. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Progressive magazine reports that large chemical plants are an inviting target for terrorist attacks. According to the U.S. General Accounting Office, 123 chemical plants have the potential to expose over a million people to toxic agents if an accidental release occurred. Despite the significant security risks, critics say the Bush administration has done almost nothing to assess these risks from large chemical plants due to its cozy relationship with oil and chemical industries. According to documents obtained by Greenpeace, trade groups like the American Chemical Council and the American Petroleum Institute objected to the proposed EPA regulation of plant security. Industry groups insisted the EPA had no authority to address terrorist attacks. New Jersey Senator John Corzine backed a bill to give the EPA the power to regulate security at chemical plants making hazardous materials. Although the bill got some early support, an intense industry lobbying campaign killed the measure. The EPA's own worst-case assessment of a chlorine leak estimates that a rail car transporting chlorine could kill or injure 2.4 million people within a 14-mile radius of an accident or deliberate attack. As each day passes, economic hardship among farmers in rural Montana is becoming more evident. In Macon County, rural mail delivery has been cut to three times a week, and the local hospital and department store have shut down in the town of Circle. Throughout farming communities in the upper Midwest and the Great Plains, home of 19th century populism, anger is building against the political establishment and big corporate farms that are getting the bulk of the aid earmarked for rural America. The Nation magazine argues rural voters are looking for a champion and a populist agenda to address concerns about trade, job loss, and the lack of affordable health care. As Dan Morrison of the North Dakota Progressive Coalition commented, Democrats win the inner cities, and they could win the rural areas, but first they have to recognize the pain out here. Then they have to make it a whole lot clearer that they're going to do something about it. Over the last 15 years, Democrats have lost the loyalty of rural voters. In 2000, Bush carried nearly 60% of the rural vote, up from 40% garnered by his father, George Bush Sr. Meanwhile, small farming communities are getting squeezed by Bush's corporate agenda. In the $250 billion farm bill passed in 2002, two-thirds of the farm subsidies went to the wealthiest farmers, and the biggest chunk of conservation funds went to cleaning up polluting factory farms. The Independent newspaper reports that the Bush administration is putting the 1987 Treaty on Ozone at risk to protect powerful strawberry and tomato growers in the state of Florida. The dispute concerns the spraying of methyl bromide, one of the most dangerous ozone-destroying agents still in use. It was set to be phased out a year ago by the 1987 Protocol on Ozone. Now the Bush White House has threatened to pull out of the ozone treaty if it cannot get higher limits for the controversial pesticide. Talks in Nairobi, Kenya, broke down in November after the American delegation rejected a compromise offered by the European Union that would allow methyl bromide to be used at current levels. The impasse comes at a time when the ozone layer continues to degrade, and research released this summer indicates the ozone hole above Antarctica has grown to the largest size ever recorded. A new bargaining session is set for March in Montreal to salvage the ozone protocol. Either the U.S. will secure higher levels for ozone-killing agents or, environmentalists fear, the whole ozone treaty will collapse. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari. We'll be right back.
While U.S. troops continue to take the offensive against Iraqi insurgents, there's been growing criticism of the tactics employed by the Pentagon in surrounding towns with barbed wire fences, demolition of buildings thought to be used by attackers, and detaining relatives of alleged guerrilla fighters. But despite the get-tough strategy, the number of attacks against U.S. and coalition troops, Iraqis cooperating with the occupation, and civilian contractors continues to rise. Recent suicide bombings targeting U.S. military bases illustrate what many observers predict will be an increasingly violent conflict leading up to the selection of an interim Iraqi government next year. In the face of growing resistance to the occupation, the White House has moved up its plan to transfer a degree of authority to a sovereign Iraqi government. The current blueprint calls for the drafting of a basic law for the country by the end of February 2004, leading to the indirect election of a caretaker government in June by regional caucuses. But the arrangement approved by the U.S.-installed Governing Council has been strongly opposed by some leading Shiite clerics, representing 60% of the Iraqi population, who are demanding direct elections. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with James Paul, executive director of the Global Policy Forum, who examines the considerable difficulties facing the U.S. occupation and the credibility of the Bush administration's plan for a transition to Iraqi rule.
There's really two stages in this plan. The first stage was what they wanted to do. They wanted to be in control of Iraq pretty much completely until there had been a constitution put together and then there were regular general elections. And that it was widely recognized that that was a time frame of about 2 to 3 years. So there was a lot of pressure from Germany and France and Russia and a number of other countries saying to the United States, look, it's not going to hold together that long. You better move towards some arrangement which is called a transitional government. You put a government in place, it's not a result of a regular election, but it's sort of cobbled together in various ways that seems reasonably legitimate to a reasonably large proportion of the population. That was the pressure that was on the United States in September when the Security Council, for instance, was negotiating Resolution 1511. But the United States refused to do that at that point. They didn't want that kind of a rapid transition. Now it's amazing how fast things were moving because the Iraqi resistance was so strong that the United States was forced to very substantially change that position towards the establishment of a transitional government, which was announced on the 30th of November, only, let's say, 2 months after they had refused to go in that direction. But there still were some substantial differences between what the other governments were proposing to the United States and what the United States was ready to put into practice. And the other governments were saying, look, the United States, in order to get a effective transitional government, has to back away from this and has to allow a stronger UN presence where there's kind of an international brokerage of who would be in this transitional government. If the transitional government, which is cobbled together and it's not as not based on elections, if that government isn't seen as relatively legitimate and relatively independent of the occupation forces, it's not going to work. But the United States government didn't seem to appreciate that, so they didn't bring in UN, they didn't bring in any kind of outsiders, including, let's say, for instance, governments from the region and other kinds of actors that could possibly have made the whole process seem a little bit more palatable to ordinary Iraqis and a little bit more legitimate to them. So instead, we have this arrangement that the U.S. has put forward, and it's not only facing opposition by the Sunnis, who are, everyone is saying, the leading force in the resistance, but also the leading Ayatollah of the Shia, Ayatollah Sistani, has said that he does not support the U.S. proposals for a transitional government. So the U.S. is skating on very, very thin ice in this.
You mentioned a moment ago that one of the prominent Shia clerics, Ayatollah Sistani, has opposed the U.S. plan and wants direct elections. presumably the Shia majority in Iraq would have a distinct advantage in any one person, one vote system. Where do you think this whole thing is going to go in terms of a plan that may have to be changed and adjusted for all the opposition that you've outlined has come at it from the Iraqi populace?
Well, I suppose there will be some concessions that the United States, that Bremer and his people will have to make to some of these objections. But the thing is that they're constantly behind the curve. In other words, they're making concessions constantly too late. And as the resistance grows, I just don't see them capable of making adjustments quickly enough. But I think the most important thing is that they've decided to opt for a strong military response. And there was a number of articles about this, one in which there was a small town north of Baghdad that they had ringed with razor wire. And because there had been attacks on U.S. forces from somewhere in the vicinity of the town, and they were forcing all the citizens of this town to present identifications as they came in and out of this razor wire, and they weren't able to lead an ordinary life at all. So this kind of approach, which both recalls the Israeli occupation and indeed draws on it, is very explosive in Iraq. So it seems to me that it's pretty much impossible to set up a legitimate quasi-democratic government under these circumstances. The circumstances are the people of Iraq are very, very unlikely to want the kind of policy outcomes that the United States wants in that country. So the United States doesn't really want a democratic system there, and they're treating the people very, very badly. So it doesn't suggest that there's going to be sort of a peaceful outcome. Exactly where it's going, it's very hard to guess at this point.
That was James Paul, Executive Director of the Global Policy Forum. Contact the forum by calling area code 212-557-3161 or visit the group's website at www.globalpolicy.org. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who survived an April 2002 coup attempt, has since endured a national strike organized by his opponents that decimated the economy, and now faces a drive to oust him through a recall election. A coalition of opposition parties, business leaders, labor union officials, and Venezuela's wealthiest citizens recently conducted a four-day drive to collect the 2.4 million signatures required to hold a national referendum on the populist president's rule. By early January, the National Electoral Council will release the count of signatures collected by Chavez's opponents and supporters who had themselves campaigned to recall key opposition legislators. But underscoring the changing political climate in Venezuela, several hundred thousand supporters of the embattled president flooded the streets of Caracas on December 6th to celebrate Chavez's 5 years in power and to claim that despite the collection of fraudulent signatures, the opposition failed to meet its goal. Over the past year, Chavez's government has bolstered its support in Venezuela's impoverished neighborhoods by increasing its funding for education, housing, and health care, benefiting the nation's poor majority. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Eva Golinger-Moncada, an international human rights attorney and executive director of the Venezuela Solidarity Committee, who assesses the recall campaign and the increasing political and class polarization in Venezuelan society that many say will continue whatever the result of future referendum elections.
President Chavez was coming forth and saying that their preliminary figures from what they witnessed and what they saw during the four-day signature drive showed that the opposition did not achieve the 2.4 million. Now, we won't know that until they're officially verified and certified by the National Elections Council. At the same time, the government is very confident that they did not achieve that level of signatures. I mean, you can witness it in Venezuela that there's actually not that level of opposition to President Chavez. You see that here in the media because the media that is aired in the United States is directly coming out of private media in Venezuela, and the private media in Venezuela are some of the leaders of the opposition movement. And what they project within Venezuela is all anti-Chavez. But December 6th is actually the five-year anniversary of the Chavez presidency. So there were millions and millions in the streets celebrating the 5 years of when, in 1998, President Chavez won for the first time. So that was the massive celebrations you saw or heard about in the news. And at the same time, I mean, of course, Chavez, when he spoke for his typical few hours of speech to, you know, his constituency, did, of course, declare once again that the opposition had not reached the level of 2.4 million signatures and that victory was declared on the side of the government. We won't know for sure until, you know, we get the results from the National Elections Council.
What can you tell us about the alleged irregularities on both these signature drives?
Yeah, well, I can say that during the pro-government or anti-opposition signature drive a couple weeks ago, the only irregularities that were in any way denounced were just saying that public employees who work for the government were told that if they signed that they would lose their jobs. I haven't seen any evidence of that. Whereas during this past signature drive against President Chavez, I saw physically the evidence of these little cards that they were giving out at the signature drive table saying, verifying that I signed the petition, this is my name, this is my national ID number, and this is the date I signed. And these were created by an organization, private group called Sumate, S-U-M-A-T-E. They have a website. They have been the principal financial force and the ones making the biggest sort of media hype about the signature drive. Apparently, they created all these cards. What employees were saying, people who were going to signing, there was a lot of people complaining about the fact that they had been forced to go sign the petition and that if they didn't return with that card, that they would be fired. So, I mean, there were actually a lot. I mean, I could say there were thousands and thousands of people who were denouncing that they had had that type of experience. There were international observers there from the Organization of American States that were certified and accredited by the Venezuelan National Elections Council and the OAS, who also bore witness to this same type of irregularity happening, that they saw the cards being given out. They asked people, why were they getting the card? They heard from firsthand from Venezuelan citizens that they were told by employers they would lose their jobs or they would lose their access to food or whatever the particular situation was. So now it's really very heavy responsibility lying on the National Elections Council to really do their job and to do it in a way that's fair and balanced and legal, and for them not to be corrupted and not to be bought off, because of course that's always a concern, is that any member in that Elections Council could easily be bought off or somehow participate in the fraud.
There are observers of the situation in Venezuela that say both sides will lose in the short run because things don't look good. If the opposition doesn't get the number of signatures required to have the referendum, they'll cry foul, no doubt, and castigate the Chavez government for blocking democratic referendum. On the other hand, if they win, there's certain to be chaos around any future referendum and election, as well as a controversy over whether President Chavez could run again in any subsequent election called after a referendum. Maybe you could just speak to that as we conclude here.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we're wondering if we're up against a lose-lose type of situation, that even if the opposition doesn't achieve the number of signatures needed for to even have a referendum, you know, not even to get to the point of having 60% of the population vote to recall President Chavez's mandate, that they are in fact going to institute some type of a plan B, that there has been some evidence of preparations around that, that it would be something unconstitutional, of course, that would involve just getting Chavez out by any means necessary, as has already been tried before. And right, at the same time, if they do reach the level of a referendum, what would happen then, you know, when they revoke his mandate? So I think that there's a lot of fear and insecurity and uncertainty in Venezuela right now is what's going to happen when those results are released. If they don't meet the level needed, what is the reaction going to be? So basically, I mean, we're on international high alert with Venezuela and are really trying to get the interest and support from people in the United States to look at Venezuela, see what's going on, be aware of what's happening, watch out for the media, mainstream media, and what it's reporting. Look for alternative media sources. Try to stay in tune, because really, this is a democratic nation, and you know, they've made it through a coup, which is extraordinary. Not many nations can say they made it through a coup just because the people came into the streets and brought back their elected president.
That was Eva Golinger-Moncada, an international human rights attorney and executive director of the Venezuela Solidarity Committee. Read Ms. Moncada's articles and many others about the situation in Venezuela online at www.venezuelaanalysis.com. December 1st marked World AIDS Day, and the big news this year was that the government of China has finally publicly acknowledged its AIDS crisis and promised to take steps to combat it. Less than a week before World AIDS Day this year, the UN released its annual report on the state of the HIV/AIDS crisis, which revealed that the pandemic is continuing to spread at an alarming rate worldwide. New figures show that more people were infected with HIV and more people died of AIDS this year than ever before. Currently, more than 40 million people are living with HIV/AIDS across the globe, with two-thirds of them on the African continent. Africa Action, a non-governmental organization based in Washington, D.C., organized World AIDS Day events on 20 U.S. university campuses as part of the group's Africa's Right to Health campaign, which seeks to end the social injustices that have given rise to the HIV/AIDS crisis. Africa Action's Most Wanted campaign has condemned the Bush administration's policies for failing to improve access to life-saving AIDS treatments. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Solly Booker, executive director of Africa Action, about how his organization observed World AIDS Day and their goal of tearing down the obstacles which stand in the way of more progress on combating the AIDS pandemic.
Well, the main thrust was to add sort of a political edge to World AIDS Day. Traditionally, the day has been a day of remembrance of those fallen to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And we felt very much that one of the most important ways to mourn the fallen was to fight for the living. And we wanted to use the day to point to those who are most responsible as obstacles to a much accelerated fight against the global AIDS pandemic. And we targeted George Bush and a number of his key advisors because he's made some very significant promises about increasing the U.S. role in the fight against AIDS, but he's been reneging on those promises ever since he's made them in his State of the Union address in January of this year.
In what way has he reneged on it? My understanding is that a lot of that funding, I don't know if all of it, but much of the funding has been passed in Congress. Is your understanding that the money has been appropriated, but it's not going through maybe the channels that you think are the right channels?
The president made his promise in January 2003. He referred to it as an emergency plan for AIDS relief. And indeed, it is an emergency. And yet he asked for no new funding for the entire year of 2003. So here we are at the end of the year looking at a death toll due to AIDS of almost 3 million people worldwide, many of whom could have been saved if they had access to antiretroviral treatment. So the first problem is that he didn't give this initiative the urgency that is required. He promised $15 billion over 5 years, which works out to $3 billion a year for U.S. funding to fight AIDS. In his budget request that he sent up the week after his speech, he only asked for $2 billion. Now, the Congress did better than the president. They authorized annual expenditures of $3 billion a year to fight global AIDS. But that's just the authorization. The Congress actually has to appropriate the money. And in the recent weeks, the Congress has provided more than the administration requested. They've prepared to appropriate $2.4 billion for next year, for 2004, which is more than the $2 billion that the Bush administration requested. That money, of course, is tied up with all these appropriations bills that the Congress is now going to consider as an omnibus package. So it's not enough funding. It certainly is more than the U.S. provided in previous years. But when one thinks of how much the U.S. is spending in Iraq, $4 billion a month, for the war and the occupation of Iraq, $4 billion a month, and yet the White House is unwilling to spend the $3 billion a year that it promised on for fighting global AIDS. AIDS is the greatest global threat to human security right now. It's a greater threat than terrorism or even weapons of mass destruction. It's killing some 3 million people a year, undermining even more families and destabilizing countries' economies, particularly in Africa and other poor parts of the world. The United States is creating an entirely new bureaucracy to manage the AIDS money, and this is most unfortunate because the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria was established in 2001 with U.S. support, and yet the U.S. has been reluctant to provide it with adequate funding, such that the Global Fund is now almost bankrupt to respond to the proposals it's receiving. And yet the United States has only been willing to provide it with some mere $200 million a year. When President Bush announced his new initiative of $15 billion over a five-year period, he decided to create a new duplicative bureaucracy, I would say wasteful bureaucracy, and he then appointed the former head of a U.S. pharmaceutical giant, Eli Lilly, to direct this Global AIDS initiative out of the State Department. So you have this new bureaucracy at the State Department to handle AIDS money. You have a new Millennium Challenge Account initiative, which is separate. And both of these are examples of American unilateralism, an unwillingness to pool our resources with other resources from donor countries in order to ensure that the poor countries can focus on the fight at hand, that they don't spend all their time dealing with dozens of different donors, but that they can access resources in the most straightforward, simple, and transparent way.
That was Solly Booker, Executive Director of Africa Action. For more information, call Africa Action at area code 202-546-7961 or visit their website at www.africaaction.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.